Don't you just love technical interviews with someone who just saw your resume like 5 minutes ago, asking you to write some code on a whiteboard, probably code that has nothing to do with anything you've done before or anything you will do at the company? No? Well, neither does Nathan Ashbacher. So when he started to build the team at his company, he decided to do things differently. Welcome to Test and Code. If you've found value in this podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go over to pythontest.com and look either in the top menu bar or in the bottom footer? And there's a few links we're going to talk about. Contact is how you can get a hold of me. Newsletter is how I can get a hold of you. And support is how you can find links to things like my book, the PyTest book, PyTest courses, the community where you can ask questions, and that's about it, really. I'd really appreciate if, especially if you could sign up for the newsletter. I'm trying to collect emails of people that might be interested in similar topics. Welcome, Nathan, to the show. And this is your first time on Test and Code. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Hello, Brian. Thanks for having me here. So my name is Nathan Ashbacher. I am the co-founder and CEO of a company called Oxen. We build software for doing sort of continuous verification and validation of robotic systems, more or less, or I guess cyber-physical systems. So software that touches the real world.
Cyber-physical, that's a great word.
Yeah, well, it's when we were raising money for the company originally, nobody knew what that meant. But fortunately, in the last couple of years, it's become a much more common niche word, I guess. But it is a cool word. I agree. It has all of the things that have real meanings, plus all of the nonsense that you want in a term used in tech. So,
okay. A little bit more specific. How about an example?
Yeah. So like a lunar rover or, wave power generation system or an autonomous car or an autopilot drone, these kinds of things. So piles of embedded components talking to each other, trying to achieve some larger mission, and the things that they interact with, right? So sometimes that's like a command center that's trying to keep track of them all. So a lot of folks who are dealing with testing are often dealing with testing, like one program, or they're dealing with, some integration between a handful of different services. And for us, it's more about kind of a broader, more general sense of a system. So, interactions at a control panel, as they go down and filter their way to how does that affect the control cycle on a robot that's doing sort of sensing and deciding and acting? And then what is the reaction that that causes on something that's in the environment that may be instrumented somehow to take some kind of signal about the reactions of the robot in the space? So the focus tends to be like primarily on the embedded space on the integration side, but the use cases tend to be more, they call them systems of systems. It's kind of like the terminology for them. Yeah.
That actually sounds like a ton of fun.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, sometimes we'll, depending on the audience, we'll kind of talk about in the software space, there's, chaos engineering has become a kind of brand identity or, like a name or a practice that has gotten popularized somewhat recently. Yeah. And so I was a contributing author to the most recent O'Reilly book by Casey Rosenthal and Nora Jones, not the musician, the Jelly co-founder. And my section was on cyber-physical systems. And it is super fun. When we're starting to work with a lunar rover project right now, a team putting together a lunar rover that's supposed to drive around the South Pole of the moon looking for water, and kind of starting at system level testing, and then we'll kind of transition over time, I think, into the more adversarial exploratory chaos engineering type things, because they want to bleed out risk before they launch it to the moon, right? And so they're being able to say, we're going to try to get chaos engineering on the moon in 2023 is kind of a really cool thing to think about. Nerd me, 11-year-old me is very excited.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So is a lot of the work in simulated stuff are you using physical stuff?
Both. Yeah. So the way that we set up our stuff is that it's kind of a additive or kind of bolt-on infrastructure to testing processes or automation that you may already have. So, if you have a software in loop environment or a hardware in loop environment or a simulator in loop environment, then Really, our platform is about the collecting event and signal data about what's going on. So data from the test harness, data from the simulator, data from the system itself, bringing that stuff into a backend and then essentially evaluating over that. So we're looking to answer the same kinds of questions you might ask in like model checking, except for we're asking them over what we've observed rather than, you know, what, you know, than some formal specification. The part of the reason for the exploratory testing bits that we do have to do with trying to make that model more rich, right? So just having an empirical model of what you, the happy path and maybe a handful of sad paths that you saw, is not that great of a model. If you're trying to sort of more fully verify or validate the behavior of a complex system, you want to try to drive it into situations that are going to be abnormal or edge cases. And so we have a pile of infrastructure that you can kind of bolt onto simulation or to exposing parameter points that we can fiddle with, like stress points in a system, to change those parameters and try to get the system to do something interesting to enrich that model more.
Wow. That sounds cool. Casey used to be a Portland person as well. Did you know Casey when he was here?
I did. Yes. I worked for him at one point. He implicitly hired me at Basho. We both were Basho React guys at one point. And so we worked together for a while there, and we've known each other ever since. I was sitting next to him when he got his, at a coffee shop here in Portland, when he got his offer to go to Netflix. We've known each other for a while.
And this is all fascinating. I really should have asked you on to talk about testing systems, because that is, or systems of systems. But instead, I want to start and talk about a zoologist.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was how, that's right. That's how we originally, I guess, virtually met. Yeah. So, I had an interesting experience. So, Lauren, Hochstein at, who's at Netflix actually, posted, he had a tweet about, you know, something about, zookeeper incidents are rare, but they're epic or legendary or something like that. And so, and I had one, I was like, he's absolutely right. But not in the way that he thought. It's true that when so many things critically depend on zookeeper, that when it tips over, really bad things tend to happen. In my particular case, though, I was in a situation where I joined a team that was starting to build out a lot of infrastructure for basically payments, like transaction processing stuff. And we were trying to scale the team pretty quickly. And so, you know, you get a lot of resumes come through. You end up getting kind of signed up for interviews that you didn't necessarily, you know much about before you sit down in the room and start, you know, talking to folks. Okay. Just sort of typical tech hiring practice, right? Like throw an engineer in a room with another person who's unsuspecting and see what happens. And so, you know, we sit down and the CV is in front of me and I'm just looking at it and going over it. I'm scanning it and there's nothing on it, literally nothing on it about anything to do with software development or IT infrastructure or any of this. And I was like looking at the person sitting across the table from me and I'm going, what is this about? I see a lot of experience. Like it seems like you've worked with, you know, at zoos, you've been like an animal caretaker. What is happening? And they just looked at me like, I don't know, but you called me in here. Right. and finally things started to piece together and I went, oh, I know what happened. And they went, yeah. And I go, there's a technology called Zookeeper that's on the rec for this, where we say like experience with Zookeeper a plus. I gather you're an actual zookeeper. And they went, yeah. And I was like, okay. And then of course I'm like, my brain's catching up with myself, right? And I, you know, as we're sitting there kind of talking, it's fascinating. Like I didn't know nothing about zookeeping. So I asked a lot of questions about that. And I was really, you know, curious and interested. But I just like after a little while went like, well, you know, I understand kind of what happened. I get it, right? It's like, you know, recruiting tends to look for keywords and they reach out to folks. And, you know, depending on how fast hiring has to happen, there's, you know, only so much kind of diligence that can be done. And usually the diligence is both sides. You know, one side goes, that's like, I get a bunch of, you know, here's a fantastic JavaScript job for you. And it's like, I'm CEO of a company now. I can't do that. And so it's like there's the diligence on the other side going, you know, this isn't for me. No, thank you. Right. And so I went, well, why do this? Why are we sitting here? Like, surely this made sense to you. You know, that this wasn't that this, all the rest of it was about software. And they went, yeah, but I don't know. It's Silicon Valley. Like you people spend all kinds of crazy money on things that make no sense. I didn't know. Maybe it was some kind of, you know, petting zoo feature. And I went, oh, okay. That's, I mean, that makes complete sense. If you've recently watched the show, like that makes complete sense. And so The best part
I mean, I've heard of Google and Microsoft hiring like poets and things like that.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. I was the first interview of the day. So they decided like not to go on and do the rest of them. Cause like, and I think, or, you know, it's possibly just kind of when I notified, I was like, hey, this doesn't make any sense. They went, oh, we should just stop this. Yeah. But I really wanted to hire the person. I think Casey might've followed up on Twitter and he was like, yeah. The funny thing is she really wanted to hire him. I was like, yep, that's true. I really wanted to find a reason.
So if people have not actually used Zookeeper is an Apache thing, but I've not used it. What does it do?
It's like consensus as a service, basically. So, you know, it's been a long time since I had to deploy it for anything either, but back in the day, it was largely a key value store that gave you distributed, essentially consensus consistency for key value things you wanted to store. So it gets used for like service discovery and, you know, configuration, you know, template management, things that where you need to keep a global sense of something, you know, for all the rest of your infrastructure to pull on. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so I reached out just because I really wanted to hear the story just from you. And this is hilarious. But then you said that you have, you hire now because you have a company.
Yeah.
How big is your company?
Yeah, it's not that big. We're still under 10. We have a couple of reasons. Like one is we're still fairly early stage. It's a long road for companies like us because the kind of the OT rather than IT space, the operational technology space just tends to move a little slower. There's a lot of big logos, you know, there's like the Lockheeds and the, you know, Volvos and companies like this, and they tend to move at certain speeds.
But even those, the projects are longer scale.
They're larger scale, longer scale. But for us, that means like we have to stay lean longer, you know, that's kind of the thing in terms of like scaling out the company. But the other part of it too, is that just as a thesis, my co-founder and I, tend not to buy into the hyper growth model of, we've seen it fail so many times, you know, even companies we've worked with that got started where we first met teams there and they had 10 people. And then a year later they had 200. And every single time we talk to like the SVP and go, how's it going? They're like, it's a disaster. Like we can't onboard people effectively. You know, you can't bring people into a culture that fast, you know, people who are getting paid to do, you know, good expensive work feel eventually an obligation to start doing something. And so, you know, they don't want to sit there and do nothing. And so then you end up dealing with like, well, a lack of sort of coordination and orchestration on the one side, bringing them in, plus a very, you know, good, like sort of work ethic impulse to be producing something, then creates a different set of challenges, which is like, what do we do with all the stuff we didn't need to have happen that now exists that we, you know, and so it's just an alignment nightmare. So we're saying like lean on purpose, for that reason.
Just a short pause to shout out to everybody out there. If you want to hire a really excellent developer, but you don't want me to do anything, I'm totally reach out. Anyway,
I got some companies that I can introduce you to.
You said you have an unorthodox or a different way to onboard and hire people. So what? Let's dig into that.
How do you
bring people on?
So part of this is motivated by I've been on all sides of this for a long time. I like to say I don't look it, but I'm pretty old. I'm in my 40s now. I think it's mostly just my generally immature attitude that creates the perception of plausible youth. But I've been on the end of it where I came out into tech, like into the dot-com bubble busting. You know, so I left college. Nobody was hiring. There were the year before, there were all kinds of signing bonuses. Every parking lot, every student parking lot at Gonzaga University pre-2002 had a new Land Rover in it that like some student in the engineering school had bought because they had gotten their signing bonus and they were going to go, they use that as a down payment for a car they didn't need. Right. And so by the time I got to my senior year, the market had turned and there was no recruiting happening. I was in Spokane, Washington. I was like 5 or 6 months until my first interview even. And by the time I got there, like I was getting, you know, interviews, I was up against folks who, you know, who had been at Intel for 20 years, who had, you know, lost jobs, had kids, had mortgages, you know? And so I saw kind of like that end of it, whereas like the lean times and how, you know, the sending out thousands literally resumes. Monster.com was the only game in town back then for that kind of thing. Mm. Just sending out these resumes, no response, just miserable, you know, saddening experience, right? Now it's the happy times. Like, the job market, I'm told, is like just incredibly crazy out there. I wouldn't know because I made the mistake of starting a company. There's still this kind of a trend that has persisted, and I don't really know exactly where it came from, but I can't identify its origin. But a lot of folks talk about the tech interview. There are books about it, like, you know, Acing the Tech Interview, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's always seemed really insane to me that, especially as like engineers of systems, that we're so colossally sort of backwards on this sort of thing. Because we see a lot of people kind of mimicking the hiring practices or the kind of doing the cargo culting of like, well, what does Google do? And you go like, well, yeah, but you're an early stage 4-person company. Like, you have different criteria and different needs and different ambitions and goals in your hiring than Google has. Also, Google has many money printing machines. So, right, like they can't even tell if they're doing a bad job at certain things, right? And so, there's like the feedback signals are so much worse and so different, right?
So I just want to interrupt you for a second. Even large companies, I work at a relatively large company, but often our the hiring is a local thing. We only have a handful of people dealing with the hiring stuff.
Yeah.
It's even large companies have small. It's more like a startup.
Yeah, for sure. Stuff. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, and so then you see these kind of practices. It's kind of like what's that? There's that Ned Flanders meme. It's something like we're all out of ideas and we've tried nothing, right? Or whatever it is, right? and I kind of like have felt that way when I'd go through around 2010, 2011, like 2012 era, I was out there, you know, doing more interviews on the being hired side, you know, like trying to find a job kind of thing, and going through these really bizarre interview processes where clearly the person who was doing it didn't want to be there. They weren't prepped or primed to like do this. It's weirdly stilted and adversarial, right? In a way that just kind of dehumanizes the entire process. Often you get asked things that there's this patina of objectivity. Well, we ask everybody the same questions. And you go like, yeah, but that's a faux objectivity that you're getting out of that. It's not necessarily a great signal of, you know, having somebody stand there at a whiteboard and try to derive in real time something that took 3 PhDs 20 years to come up with that you just happen to know about because of this interview, right? And so it's that kind of thing. And so as I kind of like transitioned through my career and kind of got into these positions of, you know, being able to influence hiring processes, and then of course now ultimately like deciding what the hiring process is, I try to focus it much more on maximizing what I believe to be the real signals that you're looking for, right? That there are certain signals that these kind of traditional kind of tech hiring or interview processes look for, which are supposed to try to filter out, like, can the person write a basic program? You know, these kinds of things. But if you can't figure out if a person can write a basic program before they show up to have an interview, then then the process is broken someplace else. And there are a lot of ways to get to that answer, right? That don't require, sort of hazing a person in real time, you know, like in a weird office with a person who doesn't want to be doing the hazing and a person who doesn't want to be receiving the hazing.
So let's just pause there. Yeah. What are some of the approaches you do? Do you have them do take home assignments?
Or? No, that seems like also a little bit unfair. And so what we do is I always say, the way I kind of phrase it is, if the goal is to try to figure out if this person can do the work with your team, and you're trying to build a team that you're adding this person to, right? It's a two-way street. Like, they need to understand what it's like to what they're going to be working on and what their team is going to be like, right? And the other end needs to understand what this person is like and if they feel like they're going to be additive to this team. And so instead of conducting or constructing some kind of weird artifice as a workplace simulator, I just go like, let's just bring the workplace to them. And so instead, you know, we'll do like a, basically, I do, screening resumes, CVs, just looking for some characteristics that I tend to find for the kind of weird corners of problems that we work on. People who have tended to be who have picked something strange to align themselves to. So they're a little bit out, like if they're like a closure expert, or they're like, you know, I'm an Erlang developer. And so there's a certain amount of pre-screening that I look for there. Like, well, this person had some motivation to take on something that nobody told them they should do. Absolutely nobody told them they should do this. Their only incentive was like internal motivation. They thought this was interesting, and they wanted to like, you know, pursue it and kind of become an expert at a weird thing, right? And so I'll do like a little bit of screening for stuff like that. And then, because there's a lot of kind of self-determination and kind of agency that I look for in people, that if, you know, they run into a problem, they don't stop and just roll over, right? They kind of dig at it. They pull on people to help them, like that kind of thing. And then just do a basic sort of phone screening where we talk, and it's really informal. You know, I set it up that way too. I go like, look, I just want to have a conversation where it's two humans trying to figure out if any of this makes any sense. And then the next step after that is just set them up into like, you know, a couple, maybe 2-3 hours, if possible, of direct pairing on a real thing that somebody on the team is doing. So whatever thing they're doing that day, it could be design, you know, review. It could be, you know, digging around in some bug that's, you know, creating a problem, whatever it is, even if it's, you know, creating some strife internally, it's try to create a real experience, you know, for this person to go like, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen here. And you're going to see this engineer when they encounter this kind of problem, handle it this way, you know? And so to try to just make it be a real workplace, you know, kind of scenario, and to then, you know, then have a debriefing with both sides kind of afterwards, where, you know, talk to the candidate and go like, well, you know, what was that like? And, you know, what challenges do you run into? And which parts of it did you, you know, feel were, you know, a struggle in terms of what it was like to interact with the other person? You know, where did you feel like, you know, you left something on the table that you wish you had, you know, been able to communicate or convey that you don't feel like was effectively evaluated, you know, in that way? So that they feel like they have an opportunity to kind of essentially follow up on, you know, like how they're viewed or what the perception is, right? Give them a sort of second impression opportunity, right? And then do the same thing on the internal team side. And go, okay, like what was this like? You know, like what kinds of things did you do? You know, so I have a sense of kind of what you worked on, so I can follow up with some additional questions. And really just try to make it be more about finding good alignment to like build a, you know, a high functioning, highly effective team, and not about, you know, do they know some esoteria that they bought a book to tell them what the answer was and they got it more right than the person before them.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty cool. I really like this idea of kind of an opportunity after the, like right after, I assume it's the same day you're talking with both.
It depends, both but parties. It's sometimes it's like a couple of days, but yeah, it's soon after.
Okay.
Yeah.
Soon after to be able to say, and actually it might even be better like the next day or a couple of days. So somebody could think about
it. Sometimes to simmer and think about it. Yeah.
To say like, how was that experience? Is there something you left on the table? Or I like that part. I remember an interview I had where part of the interview was I was supposed to like just discuss something complicated or something like that. And most of my career I've been in embedded systems, but they're not like tiny embedded systems. Yeah. These are test equipment, and it's usually there's half a dozen to a dozen different processors in there speaking different languages, different operating systems. it's like an entire internet in a box with things coordinating at different clock speeds and all sorts of chaos going on inside. Coordinating all of that with APIs and different things is a complex system. It's also a system where you can't know the whole thing. You depend on large teams to understand different pieces.
Yep.
And I was describing a lot of that stuff, and I could tell the person, the interviewer, had completely checked out. Mm-hmm. They had decided that embedded was simple and they weren't listening, and it was a frustrating experience. And I never got an opportunity to talk to the hiring manager or somebody else to say, that sucked. That part of having somebody that just wasn't interested in what I had to say.
Yeah.
It didn't feel good.
Yeah. I mean, that's, it's really unfortunate too, because I feel like, you know, what has happened, obviously not everywhere, you know, but in a lot of cases, this push to try to hire a lot of people really fast, you know, to fill seats or spend investor money or whatever it is you're supposed to be doing, right? Scale. It turns the process into a meat grinder, which is not what you want, right? Like that's the way that you do like, you know, canvassing for consumer goods. You go like, hey, I got some new like widget and I want to spam the universe with, you know, as much as I possibly can. But when you're trying to build a team, like you're never going to have 100 million, you know, team members that you filter through. Right. And so the idea is to have, you know, you want to have as little churn as possible and you want it to be as, you know, high outputting and effective as possible. And so it's much more like the kind of thing you would do in enterprise sales where you're doing like very precise targeting and you're like, look, I'm looking for this. This is the way we qualify this customer. What kinds of criteria do they have? And there's a lot of forethought that has to go into it. Right. But in the absence of forethought, we replace it with machinery and scale. Right.
Yeah. And it's interesting the comparison to like an enterprise sales or something, because like that's, we have, I mean, in test equipment, we've got consumer level stuff like, commodity systems like small spec ends and scopes and stuff like that. And those are often sold through third parties of just people want a scope. So they'll go get a scope based on specs.
Yeah.
And then larger systems, these are definitely like a description that you brought up where we both the customer and the supplier have to discuss whether or not this is a good fit before they just try it. Yeah. That's not going to happen. So it's an interesting comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know,
how about onboarding? When you bring somebody on, do you think you try to treat that different? Do you do mentoring, for instance, or do
the team is so small that we all end up being, you know, kind of, everybody works really closely together. And so there's a lot of constant communication. In terms of onboarding, like I can say as an early stage company, especially in the pandemic, like we're not great at this. you know, and a lot of it is like, you know, pre-pandemic, there was an opportunity and where people kind of were, you know, congregating or aggregating, you get to do a lot of the soft onboarding, like the kinds of stuff that you know, when you're doing, you know, enterprise business development, where you're like, we go out to lunches and, you know, you get to know each other and that kind of stuff. And that's so much harder in this environment, right? Like we've hired a couple of people, like our VP of business development and another engineer during the pandemic somewhat recently, and getting them integrated and getting them feel comfortable. Like, I don't think I've succeeded at it, frankly, like just speaking as an indictment of myself as CEO. but it's something I'm, you know, aware of and trying to find ways to, you know, to improve it. And of course, like when, you know, restrictions start to wane and stuff, we'll try to do some offsite kind of things. But the, you know, probably we could provide more structure to the onboarding process. But there's also a kind of, just get people into the thick of it immediately, you know, kind of thing where they just are, to try to remove the barriers of stilted team integration, you know, where they're like, they feel like an outsider, you know, like as quickly as possible and go like, look, this person's in the trenches with us. And, you know, we're going to be brainstorming and working on problems and like, and to try to give them a voice that's at parity with anybody else who's already been on the team. Right. And that's, so that's kind of the approach, but in terms of the swag and like the onboarding and whoops, we forgot to provision a YubiKey, you know, like kind of thing. Like I gotta fix those problems.
I remember my first job at a college that was, it was at HP and I totally felt lost because I was, there was a lot of mentoring and stuff, but I felt like I had total imposter syndrome because I was pure computer science and I was getting hired and most of the people there, learned programming on the job and they were like, you know, physicists and stuff like that and electrical engineers. And, one of the guys that had been there for like ever, I think that, you know, 40 years or something like that, was talking to me and asking me questions in a meeting as if I had been there as long as he had.
Yeah.
And I went and talked to him later and I said, like, that's super cool. Are you consciously doing that? And he said, well, everybody that works here has been here less than me. And, and also we hired you because you got skills and I don't know what they are. So I got to ask you. So sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, that treating somebody as an equal from the start is incredibly powerful. And I think it goes longer, further than people realize. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know where that comes from. I'm sure I tend to be fairly self-deprecating and don't take myself very seriously. which maybe helps. Like I imagine it can be like a little bit or it can be usefully disarming, I think, in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah.
I don't really know where that comes from. I maybe like being raised Catholic and so feeling like everything's my fault all the time. but also like I struggled. Even the thing that we're doing now, like it seems fairly novel, you know, like the kind of stuff that we're doing, we kind of try to take the best of like property-based testing and the best of model checking, and like the value that they're trying to provide to the development and kind of understanding of systems and systems engineering. And then trying to take them out of the realm of academia and turn them into something that can be productionized and productized. And we don't find a lot of competitors to this, but the same token, I had it kind of drubbed out of me the idea that I would have any kind of like novel or unique insight when I thought I invented the jet engine when I was 11 and then saw a cutaway of one and went, oh, that's all the ideas that I thought I had invented decades before. Whoops. And so I kind of, okay, I'm never going to have an original idea. And so, so for me, like what that means is there's no sacred, you know, kind of like idea. Everything is like up for grabs to be able to go like, okay, let's indict this thing, you know, like, and so having new voices around the table to perform an indictment of a thing that we all kind of get a group think about, this is the way to go, right? One of the most valuable things in bringing new people on initially, right? Leveraging that outsider perspective, because you're only going to get it for a minute until they're indoctrinated and now they've become useless in that regard, right? And so, you know, being able to leverage that and, you know, and I hope that what that does is it helps people feel comfortable and that they are able to have that voice because it's actually valued. Like, I think it's the most important thing, you know, to get out of somebody in the first, you know, month and a half that they're on board before they're, you know, they're so embedded in it that it's hard for them to, they have the curse of knowledge at that point. Right. And they don't know anymore, like what it was like, you know, when they first joined. So,
yeah. I'm tripped up at 11. You independently, invented a jet engine. I think you did.
My grandfather was a pilot. And there's pictures of him back there, above my Silicon Graphics workstation. And so I got really into like material science and aerodynamics at a really young age. I had all these books that like, because I just thought it was all fascinating. And so I remember having the idea. I was like, oh, well, so this is how, you know, if you're combusting, you know, you're combusting the fuel and mixing it with oxygen and that's creating like, you know, some like amount of like pressure pushing out this way. What if you had a bunch of fan blades that were kind of increasing the amount of pressure at the same time as igniting different stages of this thing? And I had like this whole mental model for it. And then I told my grandfather about this. I was like, look at what I thought up. And I had these awful, you know, children's, you know, there was like green marker pen, you know, on a piece of paper. Then he went, that's really neat. And then we got into his airplane and flew to the Air and Space Museum in Seattle. And he showed me, and there was a cutaway of such a thing. And it just had all the parts. They were obviously much better than my imaginary parts. Because somebody who knew what they were doing had tried really hard to do this very well. But like the premise was in there and I just went, oh, okay. Like that's it. I'm not going to ever invent anything.
That's incredible though. I mean, at 11, I think I was attaching marbles and Play-Doh to mouse traps to be able to drive bigger holes in the wall from a distance. And you're doing stuff like this. It's incredible. That's pretty cool.
I refuse to take the compliment, but my mother will be very happy to hear that.
Yeah. I think I had recently gone to a Universal Studios, so I thought I was going to be a stuntman and I was jumping off roofs and things like that. Yeah. And seeing if I could safely roll down the stairs until I got told to not do that anymore.
Could you do it?
No. but we did, let's see. Did manage to figure out a way while we were doing something stupid, figure out hard-sided suitcases make a decent sled downstairs.
Oh, yeah.
But dangerous.
Open face or?
Oh, well, yeah. You kind of, the top, you kind of hold as a the top of the sled.
Yeah.
So, because you have to pull it up, because if you don't pull it up, the bottom hits a stair and
then you're done.
Beef it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But don't try this at home. It's way too fast.
No, try it at work instead.
No, we've got like cement stairs at work.
Never mind.
But the one of I want to come back to pair programming. One of the things you said is you spend 2 or 3 hours with a candidate working on a problem or something like that. Is pairing or group coding part of your daily routine at the company, or is it something you kind of only do during an interview process?
No, it's, I mean, I have to ask the team, but I mean, I try to encourage it as much as possible. I mean, it's pretty, creating that sense of, I don't know, camaraderie and willingness to kind of pull on each other for, you know, when there's help needed or something, but just kind of, I think, produces it largely organically. I mean, there's certainly times where folks go off and, you know, and kind of they're kind of heads down working on a problem and then kind of bring it back out when it's a far, you know, far enough along some path to go, or does this make sense? Right. But there's a whole dev channel in Slack that I'm not even in, that I don't, it's just for the developers to have a place where, like, there's not, you know, the prying eyes of management, you know, to like, to be able to like communicate and like pull on each other and, you know, sit down and like just pair all day long. I mean, there's been a couple of times where I don't think they actually did this, because it would probably drive them insane. But I was like, look, just pair all together. Like, we'll just all, just a few of you, just the whole day, just like be at least kind of like as though you're in the same room, working through this problem, so that when you have like banter and like, you know, chatty ideas, but they're, you know, not all engineers want to be like constantly on.
One of the challenges that I would find, I find is I very much honor flex hours. So in order for people to actually be pairing for 8 hours a day, they'd have to have the same schedule.
Right.
So, it's interesting. Have you had any feedback from people that have come on to say, hey, interviewing with you was less freaky than other places?
And we had a guy that we ended up not being able to hire, that I really wanted to hire, but because of just kind of like funding timing for us, we ended up getting a candidate in that we were kind of going, okay, like what's going to happen here with some of the, you know, revenue stuff and some the government contract things, not knowing quite if it was going to work out. But I was very upfront with him about it too. And I said, hey, look, like I think, you know, it seems like you'd be a great candidate. That's why we're even doing this. But, you know, I want to let you know that, you know, it's, you showed up and I didn't really expect it per se. And so at a time when this wasn't quite, we were trying to get ahead of this eight ball a little bit. Right. And so we didn't want to be kind of stuck with no options, you know, depending on how things worked out. And so it was just very upfront and very kind of direct and honest about it. Set up the premise. I really like your, you know, before the show, like sort of thing that you write up. I don't have it. It's not published on the website, but like, it's a similar thing where I kind of sent him, I was like, hey, look, here's what the process is going to look like. You know, I want this to be fairly informal. Like, here's what I'm like looking for, you know, try to be more clear about what, you know, what we were kind of assessing and where I had kind of question marks. Right. And kind of putting that all out ahead of time. And even though we ended up not hiring them yet, though, you know, I'm hopeful that as things, you know, progress, they took a different opportunity because reasons, and then you know, and we're, you know, getting more financing, all that stuff, so someday I'd still like to hire them. But they came back and said, like, you know, even though this didn't work out and I actually wanted to work here more than the other places that I was looking at, this process was so much more sort of positive, right, than like it became like a, you know, it was a peer like relationship, right? It was, I was being fairly transparent with, in the ways that I could, you know, around what we were facing, letting them know, you know, just as a person who I respected as a professional, right? You know, and to try to let them know, like, I have my own professional challenges. So, and here's what they are, and here's where they're creating conflict for our mutual goal here of you working here, right? So it pays off like that. I mean, that's not the first time either that's happened. That's just the most recent experience, or, you know, that's occurred. People like being treated like humans. I don't know. It sounds ridiculous to say that, but we create so many systems for reasons that are still unclear to me many times, you know, where we just fully dehumanize these, you know, professionals or otherwise. Right. And right. So it feels bad going and looking for a new job is a full-time job that mostly feels bad.
And also we have, like we were talking about earlier, some of the traditional systems like the Googles or other people, and I don't even know if they hire like this anymore, but they, at least people think they do the trick questions and whiteboard interviews and everything. It's difficult on both sides. It's difficult to find people to do the interviews. It's also on both sides, the company and the individual, but the But also, I've had coworkers that have been and team members that have been great engineers that run the gamut of different personalities.
Yeah.
And some of the best people I know are quiet, contemplative, just hardworking people. They get a hold of a problem and they don't let go until it's finished. Those are those kind of people that have to think about something for a day before they really jump in.
Yeah.
They're not going to do great in a traditional interview.
No. Yeah.
So it's, we have to be thinking about different ways to make the interview process and the hiring process more humane. So,
yeah, I mean, that's why I said, like, it's such a incredibly high noise, so like low signal value approach to doing what is probably the most critical function of building a team and creating a company, right?
It's
who's there doing it. You know, ideas are really cheap. Making them exist is where all the hard parts are. And it is just such a bizarre, you know, kind of backwards kind of way that we handle it. You know, one of the things that I hadn't really thought about it until you relayed that was, you know, I wonder, you know, you might say like, oh, well, somebody having to, you know, to pair with somebody they don't know is also going to be, potentially nerve wracking, which is true. I'm sure it's, you know, it's a person you don't know. Not everybody is, you know, as like sort of flippant and fake extroverted as I am. And so, you know, I'm sure that can be a little bit nerve wracking, but what does happen though, especially with, I guess it's like you start the ball rolling, right? Is that I trust my team, even though they're not all like me. We're all a little bit curmudgeonly, but like, they're not all like me. But they are fastidious and conscientious, right? And so if they see a person where they latch onto something and go, oh, well, they were getting it, like they were asking the right questions, but they seem like they might be a little bit apprehensive, right? Or they were a little bit kind of like, you know, socially distant, then like, that's fine. That becomes like a thing I can talk about or talk to the person about in the follow-up, just understand why, right? Then I get to learn more about their working style and like, you know, what was uncomfortable, what was comfortable, right? But then, you know, if you start at the top with trying to be conscientious about the process, you will bring in conscientious people and they will then help you cascade that, like as you need to, you know, hire more people. But if your whole system is, you know, turning a meat grinder and, you know, bringing in people who don't want to be there to ask questions they don't want to ask, to people who don't want to answer them, well, then, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise when it doesn't work out great, when the culture is a bunch of disconnected, weird, you know, things that don't align very well.
Yeah. I also like that I've been on different types of hiring teams. And when we tried to grow a team quickly once where we brought in lots of people from different groups to do the help with the hiring part, the interviewing part, that's tough because the people interviewing, holding the interview don't really care who you hire.
Yeah.
So they're not really good at, I don't think they're really good at picking somebody if they don't have a stake in it.
Yeah. So. I agree with that a lot, actually. I mean, that was one of the things that what's that thing that they say, like, there's a lot of idioms, but there's or colloquialisms. I never can keep track of which one it is. you know, it's like the most satisfied employees are people who like have a boss that like they think could do their job. So they feel like that, you know, there's somebody there that understands what their work they're doing. You know, and I feel like that is missing in a lot of cases from, you know, whether it's like structural in terms of process or just in terms of, I guess who gets promoted to run things and, you know, become hiring managers, that when that principal agent, you know, alignment breaks down, then, it seems like it can only exacerbate things. Cause the person doesn't, you kind of have to have a system of weird, what's that crazy? There's a thing that I refuse to use at a place that I work where they tried to make me use some ranking coder rank or some insane, what's it called? Hacker rank. Is that what it's called?
Hacker rank. Yeah.
And I just said, you want to distill down all these people to this ridiculous number? Like this seems really terrible. No offense to the hacker rank people. I'm sure they've been very successful, but like just on the other side of it, I'm just like, I can't imagine like putting somebody through this and then wanting to have them around. You're punting responsibility, right? You're not taking ownership of like your role in what what you, you know, if you're the hiring manager, you need to build a team. Like, you got to understand what that team's doing. You got to understand how that team works together. You got to understand like their different personalities and what kinds of folks are good at what kinds of, you know, different kinds of things. You know, I think I'd say one of the biggest challenges that like I run into, I imagine my co-founder would probably agree with this, is that like I'll get in sometimes into a situation where I'm unwittingly leaning on sort of like the weaknesses instead of the strengths of like different team members. Not because I'm like trying to, or I'm, you know, trying to like, you know, make them feel bad, but I'm going like, I really need this like to happen. And this is the person who, you know, principally if I imagine like a spherical cow of a human, you know, like could do this, but the type of work that it is or what needs to be done is kind of, you know, say I get some design work or something like that. And they're much better at sort of like, you know, implementation and like being very prolific, you know, coding, but they're the kind of subject matter expert for that area of the product or something like that. Then I end up kind of leaning on a part of that person that isn't good for either of us, right? Like they don't feel like they're being, you know, utilized and like leveraged and like interacted with in a way that's like drawing on their strengths. We're not getting like ultimately what we want, which is the best, you know, output out of that person, you know, on things. Yeah. And so I've had to develop some mechanisms for myself to go like, oh, this is just me having stupid expectations and like repositioning and reprioritizing and like who gets pulled into what, you know, and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, sometimes you got no choice. Sometimes the person's the only one available. So you got
to do it. Yeah. Especially like, you know, small team, like everybody hunkers down,
It is also interesting that even on a team, you don't need everybody to have the same skills.
Yeah.
You need to have some people that are really good at finishing and wrapping up and crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's, and some people that are really good at starting brand new things and getting the ball rolling.
Like getting the first prototypes and Yeah. I mean, it's all about getting good information and then using that good information to get good results. Right.
Yeah. Anyway, we're kind of going long, but thanks Nathan for showing up and talking, taking some time out of your day.
This is great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Happy to talk about, I want to talk in a whole separate thing about those complicated systems you were referencing, because that's right up our wheelhouse. So like, I'm very curious about all that.
Yeah. We need to schedule something else for some system testing and system evaluation stuff. Yeah. So cool. Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening to Test and Code. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact to reach out to me, or /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, you know, get a course or something. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.